Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Old Theatre of the London School of Economics for what proves to be, or what promises to be, an exciting afternoon of debate. My name's Simon Davies from Privacy International and the LSE. I'll be chairing. I'll be assisted by Ian Brown, the Director of the Foundation for Information Policy Research. Before I begin, I want to thank in advance all of the speakers who have given of their time at such short notice to be here today. I'd like to thank the LSE, Department of Information Systems, for generously hosting the event, to the sponsors who are listed on your program, particularly Microsoft, GreenNet, and Computer Weekly for their support. And what I would like to do just before I introduce the minister is say a few words about how I feel about the government proposal for an entitlement card and where I think this meeting should go. There's, without question, as the government has set out in the entitlement card document, there are a number of issues that need to be dealt with, and the government's view is that the entitlement card is one approach. But there's a couple of unfortunate issues which we must deal with today, and I must say today is the only public meeting in the entire consultation process, so you're here, historic moment. We have to resolve a couple of things. First, is the entitlement card document sufficient A, to inspire the public for a debate, B, to resolve any of the key social questions and economic questions that it raises? My view is, certainly talking to the various stakeholders and stakeholder groups, there is a view that the entitlement card document is woolly. It doesn't give anybody a hard target. It doesn't give anybody a sense that there is a concrete idea that can be debated. Hence, there has been no debate. The second point, and this is where I wish to be a little polemic, is that I find it very regrettable that the government has not engineered or inspired a debate, notwithstanding the quality of the entitlement card consultation paper. Beverly Hughes, in a letter, unpublished letter to the press, boasted that she had done 4 radio interviews out of a planned 12, 4 up until a week ago, plus an internet debate on BBC. I understand that David Blunkett and Lord Falconer haven't had much of an opportunity to engage to that extent in the media, and my sense is that there has been no leadership by government in a debate which was promised clearly by the Home Secretary in July when he launched the consultation. Now, I had looked forward today to a 3-hour dialogue, not just with the Minister, I'm very grateful the Minister is here, but also with Home Office officials. We had been led to understand that the head of the entitlements card unit would be here today. Civil servants, as you know, there's no hard and fast rule under circumstances such as this. A civil servant, head of a section, can be authorised to address difficult questions. I had a conversation at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon with the senior press officer at the Home Office, who informed me that no such authorisation was given, and the head of the entitlements card unit, although present today, will not be able to speak. So we must use our time with the Minister with great efficiency. It'll only be a few minutes in Q&A, and I really do urge you to think carefully about the questions you ask. The Home Office has promised that it will take questions on notice by email, but I'm afraid that they will not be here today to answer your questions. So my apologies for misleading you. This is a decision that had been made only in the last 24 hours. So having said that and caused some bad blood, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce the Minister, Lord Falconer, and Lord Falconer will be outlining the government's position on the ID card. I welcome you, Minister, and look forward to what you have to say.
Simon, I assume that was a subtle form of friendly introduction on the basis that complain bitterly about the person who is not here, so that the person who does come, however awful his speech may be, at least gets some credit for being here. Quite separately from what you've said, I am genuinely extremely pleased to be here, extremely grateful to Privacy International for having arranged this event, because, as Simon rightly said, the Home Secretary, when he launched the consultation paper in July of this year, was extremely keen to promote a debate in relation to it, and that's what we have sought to do, and Privacy International arranging this today is a very, very important step in promoting that debate. And I think the quicker, in a sense, we get on to the issues, the better. But just before I do that, could I just describe the process of where we've got? We published the document in July. It was accompanied in July by another document dealing with the problems of identity fraud, which plainly is an issue connected closely with entitlement cards. The document, the consultation document in July, which I think Sam was being complimentary about as a document, sets out the pros and cons of entitlement cards with a view to promoting that debate. The consultation period, which ends on the 31st of January of next year, lasts for 7 months. It's much longer than most consultation periods because we want there to be a profound debate. It reflects the importance of the issues and the need for a very thorough discussion of those issues. We've sought the views of a very wide range of organisations and the general public, and we've already received more comments than any other recent Home Office consultation exercise. The recent debate on the BBC Online, for example, generated 375 emails in that week alone. So be under no illusions, there has been a serious consultation exercise, and everybody who wants to has had the opportunity of responding to it and have responded. And what's more, it's a purposeful consultation exercise because we've left many issues open for debate in the consultation paper, including what uses we might have for the card. Could I start with identifying what the benefits could be of a universal entitlement card if it was introduced? First of all, providing better services to the public. Public services in the United Kingdom have identified their own differing ways of establishing entitlement to individuals. As a result, as you will find in the way that you deal with the state in a variety of ways, constant repetition and inconvenience in establishing your entitlement to particular services, for example, to drive. The bureaucracy surrounding the delivery of service is therefore very often complicated and delaying. A universal entitlement card, which would, in effect, provide a universal identifier, would ease all that. In times when the public rightly expect better quality of service, better informed, more easily accessible service is very, very important. Second, a universal entitlement card would help combat identity fraud. This costs the United Kingdom around £1.3 billion a year, equally split between private and public sector. If a universal entitlement card could produce a higher level of identity assurance than existing identifiers, it would be of value to the public service, to the private sector, and most of all to the public, because it would provide more money available to provide services. And thirdly, linked with combating identity fraud, it would help deal with both illegal working and immigration, which becomes an increasingly important issue as far as a vibrant economy is concerned. Those are the benefits of a universal entitlement card. Despite our best efforts, there are very considerable misunderstandings about what the government has suggested, and I'd like to knock some of these on the head, if I may. First, the consultation paper is not part of the government's response to the terrorist atrocities in the United States. The subject of identity cards came back onto the agenda after those terrible events, but we do not seek, as the consultation document makes clear, to justify the introduction of universal entitlement cards on the basis of the threat of terrorism. There are much broader issues of entitlement to service, to services, and to citizenship, and to identity fraud, which have to form the basis of any argument to support the introduction of identity cards. The debate should not be wholly focused around national security. Another myth that attracts most comment is that we're suggesting that the police should have the power to demand the production of a card. We've left many options open for debate in the consultation paper, but we've made it absolutely clear that is not something we want to consider. So we are not considering a universal entitlement card scheme which involves the obligation to carry and produce to the authorities in any shape or form upon being asked for it. It would be no different, for example, from a driving licence, which there is no obligation to carry, which is a condition of being entitled to drive, and which can be required for production on proper notice being given by the police. Also, there'll be no special card which singles someone out as a foreign visitor. If a service is linked into the card scheme, everyone who uses the service must be asked for a card, not just those we are not sure about. It would be unacceptable if only certain people were asked to produce a card. Another concern, without foundation, is that the government is planning to develop a huge database containing all the information that the government knows about each of its citizens. Quite untrue. The previous government's consultation exercise set out the pros and cons of a card scheme while not going into any detail about how one could actually be delivered. The Home Secretary was clear that he wanted to give people some idea of how a card scheme might work in practice so that we could take the debate a stage further on, so that people would actually know what it involved. People will reach a view on whether they favour a scheme, not just by considering the high-level principles, which are obviously important, but on the practicalities. So what would it mean for the individual citizen if there was a universal entitlement card? For most of us, we would get a card on the basis of the proposal made in the consultation document in the form of a photocard driving licence or the recently announced passport card. So there'd be no extra piece of plastic and no special need to make an application. If we take the passport as an example, you'd provide the same information on the form that you do now, plus a couple of extra items, your national insurance and driver numbers, if you have them. These would be used to check that you were also registered on these databases. Checking this historical footprint, as it's called, is one of the best ways of guarding against identity fraud and follows best practice in the private sector, which have already been confronted with these problems over a long period of time. This wouldn't mean that your driving licence, passport and national insurance records would be merged together. What we've suggested is there'll be common core personal information like your name, your address and date of birth held on the entitlement card database. Sensitive information such as any medical information DVLA might hold about you would stay on the DVLA's system, accessible only by DVLA staff. But if you told, for example, the driving licence people about a change of address, this would be known to the passport service because they'd be using the same address record. So they could send you a reminder when your passport needed renewing. This could save you the £45 premium you pay to renew your passport over the counter when you realise it ran out just before you wanted to go away on holiday. Hardly a fundamental threat, I suggest, to our civil liberties. Just one small example of how you could provide much better public service to the citizen. One other extra piece of impersonal information might also be recorded, some form of biometric data. This would have two advantages. It could help to link a person to a card to prevent people from using stolen cards. It could also stop people from creating multiple identities. We've made it clear that three tests must be satisfied before any biometric system would be used. First, it must be feasible. Second, it must be affordable. And third, and most important of all, it must be acceptable to the general public. People need to understand what the information would be used for and the safeguards we would apply. It must also be collected in such a way as is not too inconvenient. We're looking at three technologies: facial recognition, fingerprints, and iris photography. Facial recognition wouldn't require any changes to the way people apply for driving license and passports at present, as both of these now store a digital photograph on their systems. Most people are familiar with fingerprints, but we still need to do more to inform people they wouldn't be leaving the post office with inky fingers, as fingerprints can now be scanned electronically. Perhaps people are least familiar with iris photography, so we thought we would show people the technology and let them make up their own minds. We installed equipment in the passport office's headquarters in London and invited people who were waiting for a passport to spend a few minutes having their irises photographed. It was also in Knightsbridge Post Office for a while and is now in Glasgow. It's coming to Glasgow Passport Office. Over 450 people have used the system so far. 81% said they were comfortable with providing biometric information. The same number said they would like the opportunity to establish their identity more securely using biometric technology. We also gave people four positive points about the biometric demonstrator and five negative points and asked what they thought. 45% only had positive things to say about the experience, the most popular being that it would increase the security of an entitlement card and that the process took much less time than they thought. 52% had some positive and some negative. Only one person out of 450 had wholly negative views. The main concerns of those with some negative views were about how biometric information might be used, and it might not be secured, they feared, securely and reliably. These are important concerns. We've addressed them already in the consultation exercise, but we must do more, especially if the government decides to proceed with the scheme. I suspect that many of you here today have doubts about a scheme. From what we are gathering in the consultation exercise, that probably puts you in a minority in the country. But I'd urge you in opposing a scheme both to consider the points of principle, important as they are, but also what the effect would be on people's daily lives. Most people in Western Europe live free and contented lives with a card in their wallet, purse, or in their cupboards at home. So please contribute to the detailed debate. Think about what the benefits are as well as what the dangers are. I believe that a consensus can be reached. I look forward very much to listening to the contributions of the other speakers and the contributions from the floor. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Minister. I'm sure that will provoke a number of questions at Q&A session shortly. I'm particularly pleased to introduce to you our next speaker, particularly pleased because he has achieved a rather remarkable episode in the recent history of this country. 18 months ago, the Daily Telegraph newspaper launched a free country campaign. I think it was a very brave move, and since then the Daily Telegraph has become one of the most extraordinary defenders of freedoms that we've seen in the modern press. So it's with great pleasure I introduce to you the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Charles Moore.
Thank you very much, Simon, and thanks for those kind words about our free country campaign. I'll just explain it very briefly because it explains how I approach this issue. It seemed to me that freedom is challenged in all sorts of ways in modern Western society, in modern Britain, and that this was an area where distinctions between right and left ought to be re-examined, that we might find, if we started on this course, that there were lots of alliances in which right and left might make with one another, and that one wanted to have sought out the difference between those who believed in freedom and those who were authoritarian, and that might not necessarily cut across normal party lines. And we want to challenge different assumptions. So, for example, we wanted to challenge right-wing people who tend to think that drugs must be illegal, and we wanted to challenge left-wing people who tend to think that it would be right to ban hunting. We want to question those sort of assumptions, and we've been doing that over a wide range of subjects and with very interesting responses from readers. Now, what brings me here today, that's the context, but I think information and who controls information and what is done with information and how information is stored is an extremely important part of freedom, because information is obviously power. If we know something, and you know, to some extent the press can get power over people by information, how much more so can a government do when it can compel people to surrender that information? That seems to me a key point for anyone interested in freedom to examine. And our attitude to freedom is not that freedom is the only overriding issue in all situations. We're not doctrinaire libertarians. But what we do think is that there ought to be a presumption, like there is a presumption of innocence in English law, so there should be a presumption of freedom when we're talking about making law or repealing law or imposing rules. The person who wishes to take the freedom away, the onus is on him to prove why that information, why that freedom should be taken away. It must be that way around. We're trying to raise the barrier all the time for people who, for what seemed like good reasons at the time, wish to take some freedom away. And we try to apply that to all sorts of different situations. And so I would apply that to entitlement cards. And I would say, regardless almost of the issues of principles, we should keep probing about why does anyone assume that this would work? Charlie Faulkner says that, points out, which is true, that most other Western countries have identity cards. True. And it's true also that they're not, as a result, dictatorships. But how much benefit actually derives from this? And how much has this, for example, managed to stop terrorists? I haven't noticed it stopping terrorists in the Netherlands or France or Germany. And indeed, the September the 11th bombers who trained to fly airplanes in Florida all had identity cards, which they showed to the authorities and which were waved through. I also question whether it automatically stops fraud to have a vast number of cards circulating. And indeed, it's clear from, it's mentioned in the consultation document that is recognized as a problem. I also think we should be careful about the government saying that we have to have this because of the problem of asylum. The problem of asylum is a huge one, but if you look at how this government has dealt with it or failed to deal with it, you will see far wider questions than identity questions. There's all sorts of whether people can be deported, how well they can be blocked at the borders, what the state of the law is, what our commitment under conventions are. There are many, many issues there, and I don't think that asylum should be used as an excuse for what is something which is much, much wider-ranging. And then I think, on a more practical point, there is the question of the gigantic bureaucracy. I don't quite think that people have thought through what it means to make, whatever it is, 45 million adults have their irises inspected and photographed by Lord Faulkner's staff. It is the most astonishing enterprise, and admitted to cost £1.5 billion. I think we need to think about that. But being a journalist, what I want to do, I'm not an expert on identity cards, what I want to do is examine the language here that's used by the government in this consultation process. Because I think when you examine language and how it's used, you start to find examples of good faith or bad faith in the way that language is deployed. And I want to fasten on one or two words that are used in this consultation. I think it'll tell us something. First word I think we need to fasten on is entitlement. Why is this word being used? I suggest that it's being used because it sounds good, and it sounds as if we're getting something out of this. The idea is that, quoting here, that it will help, the card will help people gain entitlement to products and services provided by both public and private sectors. Well, that's not right, is it? That phrase isn't right. They won't gain entitlement for that. They have entitlement to that, either in virtue of being citizens or in virtue of some particular right to a health service or whatever it may be. So what's actually being suggested is that this card sort of confers an entitlement. Is that right? Surely it's a prior entitlement. What you're getting to, in fact, is, in a way, this word is truthful, because what's for certain is that once this word's introduced, if you don't have it, you won't be entitled. And that seems to me to be a very bad principle of freedom. If you want an identity card, which is what this is, why not just call it an identity card? Why have this word entitlement? Something funny is going on there. And there's another word, universal. We're told, I quote from the document, that the government it would like views on a universal scheme where everyone who was lawfully resident in the UK would need to register and obtain a card. The government, on the other hand, does not wish to consult on the introduction of a compulsory scheme, by which it means a card which everyone would have and be required to carry at all times. I see no distinction. I see the distinction about whether you have to carry it at all times. That's a real distinction. But a universal scheme which you have to have, which you need to register and obtain a card, that is a compulsory scheme. But again, the word universal is a nice word, and the word compulsory is a nasty word. And then I'm always suspicious, and I think if you look at the history of totalitarian regimes and ideological movements, they always do this. Whenever the young people or children are invoked as being beneficiaries, it seems to me to be a sort of propaganda idea is being slipped in. So, for example, one of the examples that's given as to why we have to have entitlement cards is that a card scheme could help prevent people becoming victims of identity theft and identity fraud. For example, preventing parents suffering the distress caused when a criminal assumes the identity of their deceased child. Well, frankly, as a piece of argument, I regard that as disgraceful. Of course, it is immensely distressing if your deceased child's identity is transferred by a fraudster. But how often is actually that happened? Is that really what we're talking about here? And indeed, couldn't the same process take place with the entitlement card that's being introduced? And I noticed with the government handout about all this that there is a special one explaining all this scheme for young people. Patronisingly called "You What" is the title, and it's even more patronisingly subtitled "Translating Government Documents for Young People." It's true, of course, all government documents do need to be translated, but I don't think that there should be a special one treating young people as half-witted. And what you get here is the suggestion somehow that these cards are going to be a sort of nice, slightly funky thing you can have if you're young, which will allow you to get something extra. Young people could also use it to prove their age when purchasing age-restricted items. What's coming through is, yes, now we'll be able to get a drink as a result of this. It's all somehow made to be like a jolly little sort of government version of a credit card, something that gives you more rather than actually takes power away from you. And there's a very long thing about a card which already exists called the Connections Service for school pupils, which is a series of supposed entitlements, but actually, in fact, a way of collecting more information on you. Two more words with which I shall end. One is the word simple or basic, which is constantly used about this, so that the information that is held on us by the government will be simple or basic, and there will be strict controls on it. It will only be one or two things, like your date of birth, your address. I'm sure that's what's intended, but it seems to me that once the principle is conceded that such information can be centrally held and used by all sorts of other bodies, you've those of us who are worried about it have lost, and it only becomes a matter of time to add and add and add to that, always with what appears to be a good reason at the time, like, you know, how dare you say we can't add a medical record because without those medical records there might be more TB spread around the country, or whatever it is you wish to invoke. And then I want to end by commenting on a very, actually a very Blairite word which gets used in all of this, joined up government. Whose interest is joined up government in? Who does joined up government help? Is it automatically a good thing that government is joined up? I understand why government wishes to join itself up, but is it automatically to the benefit of the citizen? I've heard it described in another context for a joined-up legal system. I'd have thought that the history of rights and freedoms in this country, and in particularly in the English-speaking world, is a system which is deliberately not joined up, in which the rights of people are protected by the fact that there is, for example, a prosecution and a defence, that a jury is separate from a judge. These are very, very important principles, that the legal system is distinct from the prosecution system, which is distinct from the police system, which is distinct from the government, not joined up, not deliberately not joined up. The separation of powers is a very important aspect of a free society, not the joining up of powers. And one of the things that is advocated in all of this with identity cards is that all these powers should be joined up. I think we should question that very strongly. So I think this language does all show bad faith. And we face with a curious paradox in which the government is, in one sense, wanting to look the whole British public in the eye, that's to say it wishes to photograph all our irises, but is in another sense not wanting to look us in the eye in the language that it uses to describe this proposal. We should be suspicious. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. 15 years ago, almost to the day, there was a meeting very similar to this in Sydney, Australia, dealing with a very similar proposal, which the Australian government euphemistically called the Australia Card. Very similar principles. And the Prime Minister, in response to this meeting, which involved everyone from libertarians to communists, said, well, this is a strange pack of bedfellows. So when I, in initial discussions with the government, asked the government to find two supporters of the entitlement card, it should have come as no surprise. The next speaker I'd like to introduce is a Conservative peer, and a woman who has much to say on this subject, Baroness Sharples.
Thank you very much. Well, it's true that I do sit on the Conservative benches. In fact, next year I'll have been there 30 years. Today I speak as a private person. I think the most important thing on this issue is, really, are we prepared to give up a small degree of our liberty to be more secure? In the war, when I was in the Air Force, I carried an identity card at all times. I had to. But now, when we possibly face far greater dangers than we even did then, why should we mind having to prove our identity? I can see no reason why we should not. As it is, we all carry some form of identity. I met a lady the other day who had a sort of a fistful of playing cards because she worked in so many different ministries. And as you know, when you visit buildings now, office buildings and government buildings, to get access to those buildings, you have to put a bit of plastic in. The public, as I have understood reading in the press and various other magazines, they appear to be overwhelmingly in favour of a voluntary card, and I do accentuate the fact voluntary, because I know which the police favour. I also feel it is definitely preferable. Perhaps it would have to be produced, as Lord Faulkner said, in, say, 7 days or maybe less. But it would be there. The threats to our liberty are not real in this instance. Of that I'm quite convinced. Over the last 8 years, or I think it's actually longer, I have raised this matter in the House with both the Conservative government and the present government. In fact, it's not many, I think it was only last week or the week before that I asked Lord Faulkner a question on this very subject. And of course, he told me that the consultation document would be published at the, not the consultation, on the results, the government decisions would be published at the end of January. And this subject is raised on many occasions, and the previous speakers have produced a different point of view, and actually I agree with the minister on many of the things he said, and I'm a great supporter of the Daily Telegraph, which I read every day. But I'm not entirely certain I agree on the countryside question, but I'm not so sure that I agree on the rest, everything. I feel actually on this question of identity cards that at last I'm getting somewhere. Perhaps I've been extremely stubborn, and I have actually in various subjects in the House raised, and eventually you do achieve success. We face the increasing threat of terrorism. And of course, we cannot beat the terrorists with a card. But we were welded some of them who seek to obtain fake identities. And this, I think, is a very painful area for many people, because I saw reported the other day that they took the identities of thousands of dead babies, and surely there must be something to put a stop to this. The cost, of course, will be considerable. I think the talk is about 1.3 billion, but as fraud costs this country at the moment 1.3 billion a year, surely it is much more important that we do try and get this right. And fraud is on the increase in every aspect of society. The government, of course, may well decide to proceed with a non-smart card and then perhaps move on to a smart card when they see the benefits. And I, for one, certainly await with interest the publication at the end of January of the government's proposals. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Just changing the order slightly, our next speaker has a great many fans in this audience. I look forward to hearing his acute analysis of the situation. I'd like to bring to stage Simon Hughes, the Home Affairs spokesman for the Liberal Democrats. Simon.
Thank you very much, and apologies to the Minister that I heard his second half and not his first half, but assumably politicians work on the basis that they need to give you a better second half, so I guess I got the best bit. About 50 years ago, more or less, I was born, and about 15 years after that, when I was living in a constituency in South Wales, huge Labour majority, Harold Wilson was in government. I knew I wasn't a Tory. I was very troubled by the central fix-it mentality of the Labour government, and I wrote away to discover what the Liberal Party was, and I got the literature back, and I read it, and I agreed with it all, and I decided I was one, above all, I believe that it was very important for maximum liberty to be with the individual and minimum control to be with the state. Little did I know, at about the year I was born, a man called Harry Wilcock, who I had not heard of then and not too much later, who happened to be a Liberal Party member, refused in 1950, when stopped by the police in Finchley, interestingly, Finchley, to produce his identity card, which the Labour government had kept compulsorily as a requirement from 1945 through the two Labour governments, because he said it was ridiculous that in peacetime he should be asked to produce an identity card. And so he was charged, and he went to the magistrates' court, and he was convicted by the magistrates, who were very sympathetic, but said, we have no option because it's a strict liability offence, but we'll give you an absolute discharge. But he was a battler, and so he appealed, and it went up to the highest court in the land, and Lord Goddard, who was not a liberal by any definition, who was then the Lord Chief Justice, said that he couldn't do anything about the fact that the conviction had to be upheld, but he thought it entirely inappropriate and wrong that in peacetime people should have to carry identity cards. And to their credit, the incoming Conservative government under that erstwhile Liberal and still with liberal tendencies, Prime Minister Winston Churchill very soon abolished it, coincidentally in the year I was born. When I first came to Parliament, there was a Tory government, and for 18 years I feared that Tory governments would introduce identity cards, and one of the arguments that persuades me that perhaps it isn't such a wonderful thing is the fact that it didn't even persuade people who were Tory Home Secretaries that it was a good thing, and some of them I wouldn't absolutely have trusted with my civil liberties, but they resisted the temptation. Now, I appreciate that the government are trying to come at it from another position. They are, as Charlie Moore said, coming at it from the position of it being an entitlement card. If it's an entitlement card, it just strikes me as it might have better come from the Work and Pensions Department than the Home Office. If you're talking about social security and welfare state issues, it strikes me the Home Office is a funny place to get your entitlement card from, but be that as it may, my personal experience is that the state is always keen, and the agencies of the state and the agencies of law and order are always keen to get more information about you than they need. And all of us should be very wary about conceding things in that direction. When I was a young lawyer, living off the Old Kent Road, coming home late at night from the Temple, catching the 63 bus from Blackfriars, going down the Old Kent Road, getting off and walking down my road with my bag over my shoulder, I was stopped regularly by the police. And eventually I was stopped so regularly that I refused to give them my name and address anymore because it was becoming oppressive. And they were just stopping me because I was walking around late at night with a bag over my shoulder. They had no other reason for doing that. And we just have to always be very careful about giving in to things that could put people who are entirely innocent into an unintended disadvantage. It could be the innocent young lawyer, but it could be the forgetful pensioner who just doesn't happen to have the card with them on the day that they have a heart attack on the bus and need to be taken to the health service, or whatever it is, where you need to prove your entitlement, particularly if you're black or Asian or Kurdish or whatever, and need to show that you're not somebody who has no claim to the benefits of the health service or the like. Now, put aside for a minute, Simon, my instinctive view as a liberal that says I resist this idea that the government should have more power. I think if anybody landed on this planet 5 years ago with no preconditioning in terms of politics and looked at the record of the Home Office, they wouldn't be hugely persuaded that it was a department they were absolutely willing to trust with all these sorts of issues. If you look at the Home Office record on information technology and records and data, I have to say it's been an almost unmitigated disaster, as the Home Secretary has admitted. The machines they've bought haven't worked, the information hasn't been processed, they've let people down. If you look at the court system, take the Stephen Lawrence trial inquiry, where the people gave evidence on the basis their names would remain confidential. What happened? Their names were all released out into the open. Yes, that was a Met Police mistake, not a Home Office mistake. If you then look at the government that said we were very keen on freedom of information before it was elected, I have to tell you, the bill, which is now an act, will only start to bite in 2005 and has huge numbers of exemptions in it. And lastly, I thought we were going to have great joy in celebrating the Human Rights Act, because we have no Bill of Rights and no written constitution and none of the other safeguards that would protect us. But within a year and a half of passing the Human Rights Act, the government came to Parliament saying we need to derogate from the Human Rights Act so that people can be detained without trial in Belmarsh as they are to this day. On the record, this is not a government who I trust with my liberty, because even if they promise much, often they actually do something else. And so I am confirmed in my instinctive suspicion by my suspicion on the evidence. And as Charles Moore said, it isn't helped by the arguments and the presentation of the case. Of course there are arguments. Of course there are arguments that the bit of plastic that I might like to use to book my cinema ticket and then collect it, or book my theatre ticket and collect it, or book my ticket to go to the Oval for the day and then collect it, and the bit of plastic card that I might want to get my money out of the bank, could be interchangeable. Of course, there would be convenience. If that was the purpose, then we'd all sign up to that. As Baroness Sharple said, we need to reduce, I happen, on a matter of principle, only to carry two or three bits of plastic ever at most, but some colleagues have hoards, and we are required when we go to work to show up. But to be honest, you don't have to work at the House of Commons, And that's something you can opt into. You don't have to drive, but if you drive, you take the conditions to go with it. But this is not about that. It's about something that, although not compulsory, for many people will become compulsory. For many of my constituents just over the bridge who rely on the welfare state, send their kids to state schools, use the NHS, they will all the time have to have these cars. You won't be able to survive without, so it becomes compulsory to many. I think we need to be very careful that we don't get distracted by the idea that it's the card that counts. It's actually the personal information number that counts. And it's actually the fact that, given the track record of negligence in government, let alone of incompetence and lack of investment and so on, handing over that bit of information on one card that opens up all your data, with all the time attempts by the government to allow other agencies to have the data. We've got in suspension the Home Secretary's proposal to allow all sorts of new data transfer to all sorts of quangos which he thought might need them. Fills me with the greatest suspicion, with the greatest suspicion. It only needs, accidentally or on purpose, the swipe of my card as I go through the entrance to a House of Commons building to relay that information goodness knows where, not just the information that it's SHW Hughes going through the door, but all the other information that's contained in that sort of collection of data. So I think we have to be very resistant. But I put to you this, what for me are the ceiling arguments. At the front of the list, I think this has only come as a proposal because of immigration and asylum issues. I think this is actually on the table because of immigration and asylum issues. The French have an identity card, compulsory. I gather there are 3 million people living and working in France who are not legitimately there because it is impossible to police a system that prevents people crossing borders, and if they're clever enough and resourceful enough for a long time, being able to avoid both working and being in and out of the country. We're slightly more protected because we're a set of islands. But it doesn't, in my view, answer the concern that people come here illegally in any event. Secondly, as was said earlier, the people who flew that plane into the Twin Towers, they had identity cards. The issue wasn't that nobody knew, didn't know who they were. They weren't trying to conceal who they were. Suicide bombers actually want you to know, in some sense, who they are. So the terrorist threat doesn't seem to me to be answered by people who are unwilling to play the system. My constituents, when they come to me with social security issues, and when I then hear about cases going to court, the court cases for social security fraud aren't that somebody said he was Charles Faulkner but wasn't Charles Faulkner. It's that the person who appeared claiming housing benefits said he was Charles Faulkner on £50 a week when he was Charles Faulkner on £500 a week. That's normally the nature of the case. It's not that people's identity is confused, it's that they then tell porcupines about their circumstances. And I don't know about you, but whenever I've been stopped by the police, the issue hasn't been, am I the real Simon Hughes? The issue has been, am I the bloke who put the brick through the window around the corner? And the police's problem, my friends, is not identifying the people they catch. The police's problem is catching the people in the first place. We have a clear-up rate of something like 12.5% and descending, rather than 12.5% going up. So let us not sell this case on the basis that suddenly illegal immigration, wicked asylum seekers who shouldn't be here, people who pretend to be one person and are the other, people who are fiddling the system, are all going to be caught. They're not. It is a complete distraction, and it's an excuse for the Home Office and government to get this power. Conclusion, be sceptical of government, be sceptical of the case government makes for solutions it's not likely to make, and unless you are persuaded, don't give government more powers than it currently has. And if you're persuaded there is a public convenience, to use a pun, in us all having some additional facility and entitlement in the private and public sectors, then let's agree what's acceptable to us, rather than be persuaded by government that this is what is acceptable to them. And the postscript, the majority may say they like it, but majorities say they like all sorts of things. and it's actually looking after the interests of minorities, of whom we may each in turn be one, that should be the concern, not pandering to the superficial attraction of the issue to the majority. They'll sign up if they don't think it's going to prejudice them. It may be too late when it does.
Thank you, Simon. On that subject of the majority, going back to the Australia card, I recall that there was a 90% support for the Australia card in July, after the campaign had done its dirty work. Within 7 weeks, there was a 90% vote against the card. All people needed were the facts. The next speaker gave us a collective heart attack quite some months ago. When he introduced, under the 10-minute rule, private member's bill for a compulsory national identity card. There were some nervous hours while we waited for the vote, which I believe the bill was defeated in the end, but nonetheless we needed a stiff whiskey afterwards. I'd like to introduce the Labour MP, Dr. Nick Palmer.
There's nothing like a neutral chairman. This is one of those issues, a bit like the euro, where lots of people have a very strong instinctive feeling of what they want before they look at the issue, and then they sort of work back to the detailed arguments. Certainly when I talk constituents about the euro, you know, lots of people feel, yes, we've got to go in, or no, we mustn't go in, and then we start debating it. And I think it's the same here, that I had a letter yesterday from a constituent who said, I pray that I will still be alive to see the introduction of identity cards. And he feels it will transform his life. And I've also met people, and there are perhaps some in this room, who feel that the arrival of identity cards signals the start of a police state. And I think we should scale back a little, both the expectations and the fears. In particular, even in this debate, with very well-informed speakers, we've been, to some extent, debating things which are not actually on offer. Simon Hughes, for instance, has raised the spectre that you might not be able to get emergency medicine if you didn't have the entitlement card. That's simply not proposed. It's not the case. And indeed, you don't even have to live in Britain to get emergency medicine. Similarly, it's been suggested that there would be loads of information stuffed into this card so that anybody who stole it and had the technical expertise could discover all kinds of information about your medical records and your tastes in library books and the films you watch on TV and the girls you like and so on. And it isn't actually the proposal. The proposal is to have a basic card. Charles Moore's derided the word basic, so I need to say what I mean by it. For 80% of people, we are talking about simply trading in a passport or a driving license, or both, for an equivalent card. So for 80% of people, the difference is only one. The difference is that they are trading in a lower security card or lower security identification for a higher security identification. And if one feels that it's very important that nobody can find out who the hell we are, then the pass was sold a long, long time ago, because most people have on them, as you walk around this, if you feel in your back pocket, I would say most of the people in this room have some means by which they can be identified. But most of those means are seriously defective. If you've got a credit card, it doesn't have a photograph of you, it doesn't have a fingerprint. Basically, if it's pinched, it is very easy to misuse. If you've got a library card, yet more. Passport's a bit more secure. Driving license, the modern one's got a photograph. But basically, most forms of identification that we have today, and most of us have wallets full of them, are low security. And I suggest that it is not a positive virtue of identification systems that they are low security, that they are easy to forge. and easy to steal. Now, I realize that lots of people in this room have an aversion to the whole idea of identification, compulsory identification systems. But if we are to have them, and we have loads at the moment, there is a strong case for one that works, one where we can actually satisfy most people that if it says, I am Charlie Faulkner, then indeed I am Charlie Faulkner. Now, the why would you want to do it? I mean, firstly, and it comes back to the issue of entitlement as opposed to ID, it is in order to demonstrate that one is entitled to a wide range of services which are available to anybody resident in Britain or anybody over a certain age, as the case may be. And I agree with Simon that an awful lot of benefit fraud is nothing to do with impersonation. It's to do with misrepresenting your circumstances. But there is also a lot of impersonation. It is a significant racket. Secondly, it is a serious inconvenience that there isn't at the moment any one item which will satisfy most bodies that you are who you say you are. And if you have one of those irritating forms where you've got, you'll know what I mean, where you've got to produce a utilities statement and a council tax form and something from a second list, and you've got to bring them all together and you've got to show them to the post office, that kind of thing is simply a nuisance. It doesn't mean you're safer from government supervision. It doesn't mean that you're safer from having your identity stolen. It simply makes life unnecessarily complicated. The positive argument for it is that it identifies who you are and what you're entitled to. And the negative argument for it is that it makes it more difficult for someone to pretend to be you. And here we come to the issue of freedom. And I'd like to address very briefly the Daily Telegraph's Free Country campaign, because it is relevant here. One, the freedom of one is often the lack of freedom for another. Simon and I have debated in the Commons the issue of whether somebody who fulfills the criteria to come to Britain but is suspected of being a terrorist should be allowed in. Simon referred to it. Government feels they shouldn't, because basically the freedom to come into Britain is not as significant as the freedom to prevent people from being blown up. The fact that you can't prove it is a reason not to detain them compulsorily. They're free to go away again. It would be irresponsible, we feel, to actually let in people who we sincerely believe are coming in with the intention of blowing us up. Now, you can argue that both ways, and I can see there's a case the other way. It's the point that an absolute freedom is not necessarily reciprocal. The Daily Telegraph is not known for its enthusiastic support for greater freedom for asylum seekers. They are better known for their support for freedom in Britain against what they see as excessive asylum seekers. The Daily Telegraph is not known for its championing of the right of foxes not to be chased across the countryside. We won't get into that. But if we talk about freedom, what comes up again and again when I talk to my constituents is that they rate the freedom for the authorities not to know who you are much lower than they rate the freedom to be confident that somebody else is not pretending to be them. I didn't put that very well, but the freedom not to be identified is not as important as the freedom not to have your identity stolen by somebody else who might wish to do you harm or do your assets harm, who is almost certainly up to no good. The issue of linked databases has been raised. Well, on identity cards, as on linked databases, I'm more militant than the government is. I mean, it's important to stress that the government is very cautious in this area and that, it, for instance, it does not want to give the police the power, even if you're behaving suspiciously, to ask for your entitlement card, which I would give. I feel that if they believe you're behaving suspiciously, if, for instance, they think you've stolen the car and you're a joyrider, then they're entitled. They should be entitled to identify you. The government doesn't agree. It feels that goes too far. On linked databases, let me give you an example. I have a constituent who is not getting child support. She knows where her former partner is. The former partner claims he doesn't have an income, but there's good reason to think that the PAYE records show that he does have an income, a substantial income. But because it hasn't been legal up to recently to link the CSA records with the PAYE records, my constituent is getting £0 a week to support her child. Now, I think that's unreasonable. Others will disagree. And there's obviously a balance here. If you link everything together, you get to the point where the government can start sort of studying who's reading what newspaper and who borrows what books from what libraries and so on. And there comes a point where you have to draw a line. And some would draw the line at the point of basically not letting them know anything that they don't absolutely have to. Some would draw it further. But if we take the issue of joined up criminal justice system, at the moment, because the system is so unjoined up, if a policeman arrests me and takes me all the way through to trial and conviction, he has to enter my details 16 times in 16 different database systems. And that is ridiculous. It is not a sensible way of using police time. And does it protect me in any meaningful sense? No. All it's doing is making this poor bugger sit there for hour after hour, filling form after form, and then transferring it manually from system to system. I don't see that. But it is not proposed that the merger, the union of all these databases should be put onto a card. All that's proposed is that the card should be a gateway for those who can prove entitlement to the right data. And to wind up, I lived in Switzerland for 18 years, and Switzerland does have compulsory identity cards. I knew loads of foreigners, perhaps not surprisingly. I knew Trotskyists and communists. I knew asylum seekers. I knew one or two people whose status was probably not quite what it should have been. And I never met anybody who mentioned ID cards as a problem of any kind during those 18 years. I never heard of a single case of somebody saying that they've been inappropriately or officiously asked for the card, or who thought it was anything other than a convenience. And I think it is possible, going back to what I said at the start, just as it's possible to exaggerate the benefits. It won't solve terrorism, it won't cure cancer, it's a convenience, it's something which will be mildly useful against benefit fraud. It is also possible to exaggerate the dangers. And that's just a final point, that I appreciate what Simon Hughes says, that when in doubt, we should protect a minority against unthinking views of a majority. But any MP will tell you, or all the MPs who I've talked to, that if they extensively consult their constituents, they will encounter very, very strong support for ID cards, not just entitlement cards, for ID cards. And the reason they do that is partly that they feel that it will make them a little bit safer from impersonation, partly that they will want to be able to identify themselves beyond any doubt, and partly something a little subtle, which is that it would be the one item which we would all have, not because we're asylum seekers, not because we're applying for benefits, not because we're on the fringes of society, but because we are legal residents in Britain. And they feel that somehow in Britain we've lost that a bit. We have become so fragmented that we are a thousand separate little diverse groups without a common factor. And I don't want to overstate that because it's an emotional thing which has very little practical significance. But we shouldn't despise majority views either. And there is a very strong wish out there that we could have something which brings us together, which gives us this identification with ourselves and with our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. We come to our final speaker for this session before the Q&A, and when the cutting edge was devised as a phrase, I think it referred to this man, a good friend and colleague, Dr. Ross Anderson from Cambridge University. Ross.
Hi, is that in focus? Good enough. I was asked by Simon to talk about the technical pitfalls of the multi-purpose ID schemes. My name, I put it in inverted commas listening to the last talk. Ross Anderson is one of the names I'm known by, the most common name I'm known by, but one of the rights we have in this country is to be known by any name that you like. A name is not something that is given to you by the government, as this nefarious consultation document implies. It is what you are known by. And you may be known by as many different names as you like, and there are many circumstances in which it is perfectly reasonable and proper for somebody to use a pseudonym. You know, these range obviously from going to an STD clinic to such everyday things as going to find a burglar alarm. What's my background? Well, my background is in security engineering, and the technical side of this stuff. We work with things like smart cards and biometric systems and so on. And over the years, there has been a long history of attempts to introduce ID cards by the back door by linking them with some other function. The ones that I can recall and have had something to do with, there was a welfare claimant's card back in 94, I think that Peter Lilly may shortly be hands of. There was a bank-issued smart ID card that the Mondex people played around with the government. There was an attempt in 96 to make an NHS patient card into something that would double as an ID card. In the late 90s, we had the Electronic Signature Directive and the E-Commerce Act tried to make public key infrastructure into something that would double as an ID card. Then there was a talk about asylum seekers' cards, which has come along now to an entitlement card. Why do we keep on having these initiatives, none of which, in the end, goes anywhere? Well, I've cut a number of the slides out of my talk because we're running slightly over, and also because the previous speakers on our side have covered many of the important points. I agree with almost all of them. The themes that I'm going to concentrate on are, firstly, that there's no magic bullet in security technology. In fact, putting all the eggs in one basket is likely to increase the risks of everything from identity theft to terrorism. Secondly, there is no magic way to reduce the number of authorization tokens that people need to carry. This is for system reasons. And finally, there's no magic way to save the government money. It's often argued that if we can link together systems, if we can have joined up government, then this can save waste and save money. This has been promised again and again by governments of both complexions over many years, and it's never worked. The reason why it doesn't work is simple, but it's one that governments don't seem to be able to grasp. Right, first. We can't do anything. We can't do anything at this late stage about the setup of the screen, I'm afraid. But first of all, I put up these two slides as a reminder of the fact that biometric information isn't as infallible as many people think. These are the two slides taken from the McKee case a couple of years ago in Scotland. For over 50 years, the police and courts had accepted fingerprint evidence as definitive. In this particular case, a false match came up, which caused a lot of grief, and it's now undermined the whole system. The police used to claim that the possibility of a false match on 16 points of a fingerprint was 1 in a billion. Now, nobody believes that anymore, but even if it were true, an authentication system that worked when you were matching a crime scene print against 50 local burglars no longer works when you're doing computerized matching of thousands of prints per day against a database of millions. The probabilities suddenly don't work for you anymore.
As another example of what goes wrong with technology,
people have talked.
About the prospect that smart cards might make identity tokens that are very, very difficult to forge. I'm afraid we don't believe this either, and those of you who own shares in pay TV companies or have witnessed the demise of Canal Plus will understand that smart cards are a bit easier to forge than one might think. This is a snapshot from our latest hacking technology where one basically freezes the card and then laser scans it to see what the values in the memory are. So I did not bring slides. On iris scanning. Similar criticisms can be made there. If you go online, you can find descriptions of how you can defeat iris scanners by means of printed contact lenses and things like that. Next set of points. It's often argued that if you have one authentication token, it's convenient. You no longer have to carry around dozens and dozens of cards and keys and bits of plastic and bits of paper and so on. Now, again, I'm sorry I have to disappoint you. During the dot-com boom, there were companies like VeriSign and Baltimore got astronomical valuations, 11-figure valuations on the stock markets, with the promise of doing just that. They were going to give us all smart cards with public key certificates in them, which would then be everything. They'd be an ID document, they would be a bank card, they'd open your office door, they'd unlock your PC, they'd do all this good stuff. It didn't work. There are very good system reasons for this. There are organizational reasons independent of the technology. There are issues to do with branding, control, liability, flexibility. And it's summed up with a neat law that was put forward by Steve Kent, one of the original fathers of this technology. He said the useful lifetime of a token is inversely proportional to the number of things that it's good for. So in countries where they really understand and use ID cards, such as Germany, what they go for is a card that is only an ID card. They do not let it double as an entitlement card or a medical card or anything like that. The security is based on funny optical effects like modern banknotes, and there are all sorts of rules to prevent people using the ID card number for other purposes. For example, they change it every time you get a new card. Money is something that is also brought into the argument. Now, there's a more general point to be made here, which is that many governments think that they can save money by consolidating a number of systems into one, and it almost never works. And the reason for this, the fundamental theorem of IT economics, says that in this business, the value of your customer base is equal to the total cost of them switching, right? Because if you're an ISP and you've got a whole bunch of customers who will have to undergo about £50 worth of inconvenience to change to another ISP, like telling everybody their new email address, then if somebody else can come along and make a business model out of paying your customers £60 cash back to switch, they will. And so this is why, when you have a number of different population registers as we have at present with tax, NI, DVLA, passport, and so on, none of the operators of these systems can hold the government to ransom. However, if you roll them all into one or link them all into one, then the company that gets the franchise for that will have the government over a barrel. If you don't believe me, read the technical press coverage recently on the renewal of the EDS contract for the Inland Revenue. None of the other facilities management companies decided to bid. Why? EDS are now too dug in. You know, they have got us as their monopoly customer for the foreseeable future. So in summary, in addition to the liberties issues that I thoroughly support, there's a whole bunch of technical reasons why trying to build a multifunction identity mechanism is a bad idea. It'll lock in the government. It'll end up being expensive and inflexible. This is why the people who are supporting it are companies like EDS, who think that they can make vast amounts of money out of it. And of course, there's the usual obsessors from places like the Home Office. Don't believe the claims of side benefits. There are not going to be enormous side benefits, and don't believe technical claims of security. However, these technical things having been said, I think this will ultimately be a political decision, and I brought along this so that you could have a look at it. My wife is from South Africa, and her great-grandparents came from South India, And so she grew up with the indignity of having to have a dom pass, an identity document. And I asked her for hers, and she'd thrown it away in disgust years ago, but this is our daughter's. And you've got your identity document, you've got your endorsements, your record of voting, non-driver's driving license, because she was too young at the time to drive, spaces even for firearms licenses, not even a non-shooter's firearms license for an Asian female, and so on and so forth. It's been tried. The idea of a multifunction identity document has been tried. And I can tell you the view in our family is that if this is introduced, we are going to be one of the refuseniks. Given our circumstances, there's no other course. Thanks.
Thank you for that, Ross. Thank you for that. Before we go to Q&A, I have to say I have an eye condition called pendular nystagmus. With that condition, there's an upside and a downside. The upside is that I can stare into a retina scanner from here until the next Conservative government, and it's not going to do anything. The downside is I can't see people very clearly. So for the question and answer session, I'd like to bring up my colleague, Dr. Ian Brown, to chair this session. Ian.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Simon. If people could keep the questions relatively short, because we don't have too much of, especially Lord Falconer's time. And also, if you could wait for a roving microphone, please.
Yeah. I'm a historian by trade, and we tend to take the long view. One of the provisional lessons of history is that, in the long term, political stability is the exception, not the rule. If we implement this procedure of identity cards for the poor, we're not only trusting the current government to implement them and not misuse them. We're also trusting future regimes. We're trusting potential hostile foreign regimes. We're trusting non-governmental organisations who might want to get their hands on a database for whatever reason. I'm sure that when the precursors of Interpol set up its shop in Vienna, they weren't expecting the Gestapo to take over their records in 1938. Have the Home Office considered the long view? It doesn't appear to be in the consultation document.
We make it clear in the confrontation document that you would need absolute security in relation to any database that formed the backbone of a universal entitlement card scheme. There are other countries, as both Ross has referred to and history tells us, and if you look at the back of the consultation document, you'll see what other European countries have done. They have, in very large measure, been able to protect the database which forms the backbone of the system. But in principle, you are right that before you could introduce a scheme, you would have to be sure that there was adequate security in relation to it.
Any questions upstairs?
I'd like to make the point that, in fact, there's no such thing as absolute security. But quite apart from that, I'd like to hear from the Minister, what will there be in the way of legislative and procedural safeguards for function creep in the future?
Well, you're absolutely right that there is no such thing as absolute security, but I don't think anybody in the room would take the view, for example, that you shouldn't have a confidential record of people's previous convictions. We recognise in our society that there are risks in relation to databases, but if you don't have those sorts of databases, you have worse problems. For example, people's medical records. The danger of people's medical records being spread about in breach of confidence is significant. But is there anybody in the room who would suggest we shouldn't have medical records? The fact that you can't have absolute security doesn't mean you shouldn't recognise that there are certain benefits, if there are adequate safeguards, to have databases. As to what legal safeguards you would have for the sort of creep that you referred to, you would require primary legislation to use the information for any other purpose than that specified in the primary legislation.
Okay, this gentleman over here with the white hair.
Mr. Moore was quite right to use an Orwellian analysis of language. He was picky about words. He did, however, use the term Blairite. may I suggest to him that that indicates some ideological content or principle? Wouldn't it be preferable to use the term Blairhead? Just as an airhead is one without brains, so a Blairhead is one without principle.
I can't disagree.
I'm a GP in inner city London, and we have an enormous number of refugee patients. I wanted to raise two health-related questions. One is to do with the unique identifier requirement that we perceive a need for. When patients register and they don't have a medical card, they give their name and it's sometimes misspelt, and therefore a new record is created on the health service every time, and therefore there's list inflation, so that the actual registered population with general practitioners is vastly different to the actual true number of people in the population. And I see a real need for doing something about that, particularly with the way the new GP contract is looking. The other issue is to do with actually currently the systems that exist. GPs are being asked to police the system on behalf of the country. We have patients who arrive in this country with pre-existing conditions, and we register them in good faith in general practice because they're coming here to live, and we refer them then to the hospital, and the hospitals refuse to see them because they're pre-existing conditions. Our terms of service require that we refer them to the hospital because they're sick, and they're left with us to look after, and yet the hospitals won't look after them. This is a recurring problem for us, and we really need it sorted, and we are not the police of the state.
We've got time for a couple more questions.
Could I just make a point? I think that it does raise some very important points. Professionals deal with people professionally. They are fulfilling their particular duty, which, as you, in your case, is medical, and it could be legal, it could be accountancy, whatever. If the information that they received somehow had to be vouchsafed to others or used by others, it would be a breach of their professional duty. And I think, I know that that's not precisely suggested by entitlement card proposal, but I think it's a natural, likely consequence that information starts to be centralized and used for reasons which you as a professional wouldn't want it used. I also think you raise an important point about the spelling of names and so on. One of the great assumptions about introducing all of this is that it's going to work. And this is a false assumption for reasons that Ross Anderson put forward very well. It's not technically going to work. It's extremely hard to collect accurate information about people. It requires millions and millions of individually attentive human decisions. And the more it's aggregated, and the more it's insisted upon, and the more it's bureaucratized, the less likely it is to be right. And those introducing it will say, and indeed we heard it today, particularly from Lady Sharples, that this will solve a lot of things, or now we'll have proper information. And that in itself is an oppressive belief, because what will happen is that great emphasis is put on the power of particularly the scientific tests, because people always put great weight on scientific tests, particularly non-scientists. And it will then be said, well, it must be right, because the iris recognition is right, or the fingerprint is right, or whatever. It's not true. And if you look at the history of oppressive convictions in the criminal court, for example, they very frequently arise from an undue faith put. The Guildford Four were convicted on nitroglycerine tests to do with how they must have been handling bombs, it was alleged, because nitroglycerine appeared on their fingers. Well, first of all, you have the question of whether actually people might have put it on their fingers in order to prove their point. But apparently you could get the nitroglycerine from playing cards, for example. So... I'm sorry, but forgive me. The point stands. So I think a great deal of... there's an idea, which is a very governmental idea, of course, that one great big solution exists. And all our experience shows that both in practical terms and in liberty terms, the opposite is the case.
Can I just... that's a classic sort of lawyer's argument there. Because what Charles has done is taken a different argument from that being advanced in the consultation document Is that better? Yeah. Sorry about that. what the consultation document is saying is the universal entitlement card, if a scheme can be found to work, should be a means by which you can prove your identity. There are other countries where that has worked, and Germany is an example, and Ross identified that specifically. Nobody makes the claims that Charles is making, that it provides a solution to every identity fraud, to every case of wrongly getting an entitlement to service. It is simply a means whereby you could reduce identity fraud. You might well be able to deal specifically with the first problem the GP asked about in the first part of your question, which is because names sometimes provide difficulty, GPs appear to have very large lists which don't in fact reflect reality, which reduces the amount of service that they can provide. Why not have a system whereby people's identity is easier to find? Now, that's a typical example of what can be achieved. It can be done scientifically. It doesn't involve the sorts of infringements to freedom that have been talked about. The debate has got to be about the extent to which freedom is infringed against the benefits to be obtained. But please let us have the debate on the facts rather than something else. When Charles began to suggest in his speech that what entitlement cards threatens the independence of the judiciary, I wondered whether we were having the same debate.
Well, that's a wonderful lawyer's point in turn, and unlike my lawyer's points made by a lawyer, that wasn't what I was that wasn't what I was saying at all. But I do think we should ask ourselves, why does the government want to propose this?
And the answer, give the answer then. The answer is to provide better services for the citizen, to reduce benefit fraud, and to identify who is legally here and who is not.
Are we answering questions, or are we having a debate?
Yeah. Could Nick just quickly make his point, because he wants
my point's been covered. Okay. I think we should let a few more people get in.
Certainly.
I suspect, say, one sentence worth of something, which is that the one thing that's missing from the consultation paper is any assessment of the Constitution and civil liberties implications. And unless you have that as part of all the debate, you actually don't have the whole debate. And that's the great weakness, Charlie, in the paper that we've got.
Okay, we've got time just for a couple of quick more questions. The gentleman with the pink shirt right at the back.
Thank you. Yes, 2 points. First, the utter hypocrisy. It seems important for the people putting forward this idea to claim that they have a democratic mandate. I'm sorry they're offended, but that is total hypocrisy. You have no evidence to say that you've got 80% of the population. Right? We have government after government claiming a mandate on perhaps a third of the vote. No government has ever managed to get over half of the electorate to vote for something they're in favour of. So that is total hypocrisy. The second item is that several people who've spoken don't seem to realise that many of those countries that have a compulsory ID card, it is not compulsory to carry it. France is a case. But you go and stand outside the metro stations in Paris when the state security police, they're the ones in navy blue fatigues, decide to check on people. First of all, you'll see who gets stopped. It's not middle-aged white people. Right? And then when you're stopped, if you don't have that ID card, which it's not compulsory to carry, that will be a reason for keeping you on one side. You can't be arrested for not having the ID card, but, well, why haven't you? You have to tell us who you are. We need to know we're investigating something. Thank you. I'd like to know what the government's answer to that is.
Is there a quick comment from anyone? Or?
Just,
how would you stop the police doing that?
First of all, as far as the democratic mandate issue, what we've done is had a consultation, and we're in the process of having a consultation, in which it must be sensible and legitimate to find out what people's views are and seek to gauge the level of support and the level of opposition. And that's what governments do regularly. It's a sensible thing to do. As far as the second point is concerned, if you're not carrying a card that you're not obliged to carry, nevertheless, that is something that the police or the authorities will hold against you. Well, they don't in relation to driving licences at the moment in this country, so why should they in relation to universal entitlement cards which you're not obliged to carry?
On the mandate point, I mean, it's perfectly true. We haven't got over 50% of the vote. Well, on that basis, we don't have a mandate to do anything.
Yeah.
but
stop claiming you have a mandate to do anything.
I don't think that we have ever claimed that we have a mandate to do ID cards. We're making what the government's doing is making a proposal for consultation. I say that I believe that it has very broad support. That is my belief, which I'm entitled to. I don't say that I've got a democratic mandate for it. I merely say that my sounding suggests my constituents want it.
Okay, one last question up here.
Yeah, we keep hearing about more secure databases and firmer technology with the introduction of this scheme. And having read the consultation report, I don't have a clear sense about what that is. One thing that does concern me from the consultation report, I'm quoting from paragraph 412, it mentions that in the case of some government departments where there was a clear justification, information could be made available without the consent of the person it related to. So I was wondering if we could just have some answer to what exactly that means and how could that possibly relate to data protection issues.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that the consultation paper makes it absolutely clear that the data protection principles would apply, and that means you can only use data for purposes for which it has been provided. The data protection principles, which you'll obviously know about, do in very exceptional circumstances, for example, for the prevention of serious crime, permit that sort of data to be provided. And everybody who signed up to the data protection principles accepts that.
Okay, unfortunately, we'll have to move on. That was a very informative session. So if everyone could please thank our speakers again. And I'll hand back to Simon.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you again to the speakers. Well, the fireworks are only just beginning. Thanks, Charles. Fireworks are only just beginning. I'd like to bring up the Peter Lilly and... Thank you, Minister. The speakers for the second session, Peter Lilly and the other speakers, if you could come up here while I just say a few words to summarise where we're up to at the moment. I don't know why we didn't have this discussion at the beginning of the consultation period, because what appears to be emerging from today are a number of very unclear areas. The first is, it doesn't seem that the government knows why it wants the card specifically, or even how the card will work. That much has become clear from the pro-government speakers, I think. The second point is, I believe from what we've heard so far today, there is a great deal of uncertainty about the implications for citizens' rights. And we could perhaps ask whether the legal protections which are in force are going to be adequate for the potential for abuse. The Minister says just now that the data protection principles apply. I agree, they do. But you could, in the words of the BMA 15 years ago, describe the Data Protection Act as a load of holes joined together. And it appears to be even more acute in the analysis of the impacts of the card and its legal protections. In this second session, we're going to take this a step further, because the hard edge to what the government is proposing forms neatly into two spheres. The first is, how, from a practitioner perspective, from a practical perspective, will it work? Second, what is the real likely impact on groups, particularly disadvantaged groups, vulnerable groups in society? I heard much applause this morning when it was mentioned, for example, that there was a degree of exploitation of children. How far is this going to go, and what is the experience internationally that could lead us to a reasonable assessment of where an ID card could take us? This panel will take us into that dimension. This is very much the hard edge of what we've been discussing today. And to begin, I'd like to bring to the podium a man who you will all know, certainly by reputation, former Secretary of State for Social Security, Peter Lilly.
First of all, I must apologise for not having been here for the what seems like a very fascinating earlier stage to this debate. I think the most useful contribution I can make is to try to put the proposals the government has put forward in the context of previous and rather similar proposals which were considered and rejected by the last Conservative government. One of the few pleasures of moving from government to opposition is that one does see tired old ideas which one had rejected brought forward by one's successors as spanking, sparkling new ideas which they've just thought of. You may remember the recurring theme of that wonderful series, Yes Minister, which was that Sir Humphrey was always trying to put his departmental ideas into the minds and onto the lips of his ministers. You think that Yes Minister is a comedy. I know it's a documentary, and this measure proves the case. We did each successive junior minister for information technology would bring before the last Conservative cabinet a proposal for a compulsory identity card. Not just any old run-of-the-mill identity card, but a all-singing, all-dancing, smart identity card, which justified him doing it as the Information Technology Minister, and it was clear that there the idea lodged in that department. And it came before a cabinet subcommittee, and each department was asked to suggest ways in which this compulsory identity card would be able to help solve their problems. It used to fall to me to point out that normally we had problems looking for a solution. This was the only time the cabinet ever had to consider a solution and find problems which it could solve. And that itself was a clue that there was something funny about this proposal for a compulsory identity card. Nonetheless, it was suggested to us that it would be useful to solve four major problems: the problem of terrorism, of crime, of illegal immigration, and of benefit fraud. We would therefore ask the relevant departmental ministers what assessment they could make of its help in those areas. As far as terrorism is concerned, that's obviously been the trigger this time for the government to bring the measure forward. It's mentioned in the very first line of the consultation paper, and it was post the 9/11 tragedy that government began to talk actively of an identity card for the whole population. The truth is, however, that terrorists, and certainly, as far as I'm aware, all those who perpetrated the attack on the Twin Towers, rarely conceal their identity, only their purpose. And it's almost inconceivable that if everybody is obliged to have an identity card, even if it asks you to express your profession, that anyone will put down that their profession is terrorism. It will not actually help us identify any terrorist, and there was no evidence that it would. We then came to ordinary crime. At first sight, it would appear to be a useful measure to help police identify criminals. The police informed us, however, that they very rarely had any problem identifying criminals, only in catching them in the first place or in providing sufficient evidence of their guilt rather than their identity in court. It was not a thing that the Home Office or the police service thought sufficiently valuable for them to want to spend their departmental budget on. So we came to the third issue, illegal immigration. And let's be frank, the basic pressure for this from the general public for an compulsory identity card comes from the belief that a compulsory identity card would be helpful in stopping illegal immigration. There is a widespread, though erroneous, view that there are millions of people out there who are illegal immigrants. If only the police could stop those who looked like an illegal immigrant or sounded like an illegal immigrant, demand that they produce their identity card, find that they had not got them, they could then be shipped back to where they came from, or at least to somewhere else. That is the widespread belief. It's a belief to which the government is pandering, but it is an erroneous belief. There are quite a lot of people, large numbers of people, who enter this country illegally. But almost always, they claim asylum. Those who enter illegally but do not claim asylum, if stopped by the police in one of these random checks, would be able to claim asylum, and they would then enter the asylum system and would not be able to be sent back to wherever they are deemed to have come from. As it is, all asylum seekers are required to have a standard assessment, an SAL, I think it's called. They're obliged, since July 1993, to have their fingerprints taken, and they're now stored on a central computer. The government is proposing to replace that piece of paper by a piece of plastic, and that doesn't materially change it as long as people are not required actually to carry it, and the government, to its own supporters who are worried about civil liberties, assures them that immigrants or asylum seekers will not be required to carry this card. But they say the card will actually carry people's fingerprints in digital form on them. I've never quite understood the purpose of this. If you stop someone in the street and say, I want to check your fingerprints, the logical place to look is at the end of their fingers rather than on a plastic card. If you check the plastic card against the database back in the Home Office, that only tells you that someone's got a card. You may have stolen it from anybody. So you've got to check their fingers. So it's absolutely pointless to have this on the card. But it sounds better and it plays well with the Daily Mail reader. But the truth is that if we did have this system, and if we move to make it compulsory to that people carry it, and empower the police to stop people who look or sound foreign, there would rightly be, within a very short space of time, such an uproar at the discrimination and harassment of people, a large majority would turn out to be actually British citizens who simply had a foreign accent or had a different, a non-white colour, that after a short while the police would actually not be able to stop anyone who wasn't white or didn't speak with approved correct English pronunciation. So the whole thing would then backfire. It is not something that in practice would help deal with illegal immigration, though that is the main driving force behind it. The fourth and last big area of government where it was alleged that it would be useful was benefit fraud. Now, I was Social Security Secretary before the idea came up in Cabinet. I did propose a scheme to replace jarry checks and benefit payment books by a benefit payment card. It would be a means of payment, and it would have eliminated the quite widespread, we reckon about £150 million worth of fraud from means of payment fraud. That's not identity card fraud, it's actually people stealing an order book and using it without having to declare their identity or anything. And just altering some of the details on the card. So that would be eliminated. There's very little identity, stolen identity or invented identity fraud in the benefit payment system. We carried out random checks of benefit claimants, and it's almost microscopically cool, small. There's a lot of fraud, but it isn't identity fraud. And so to have an identity card allegedly saving identity fraud in the benefit system is playing with words, and Lord Faulkner, I think, mentioned benefit fraud as if it was a serious issue. It isn't. Now, the odd thing is that I, having put forward this proposal and we'd started introducing it, the government subsequently cancelled the scheme for a benefit payment card on the grounds that they could not get it to work, even though it works in Ireland for 3 million people, but they couldn't upgrade it to work for between 10 and 20 million benefit claimants in this country. One has to ask, if they cannot get a benefit payment card to work for benefit recipients who are keen on the whole to have it, how can they get the system to work for 60 million people, a proportion of whom will not be keen to have it? The whole scheme, we understood, would cost something like £500 million a year. Now, that's a higher figure than the figure put in the consultation document, but it certainly indicated that somewhere between 10 and 20,000 police could be bought for the money of an identity card, and most people, I suspect, in the country would prefer to have a larger number of police on the beat rather than themselves be forced to carry this card. So we, by and large, and not all my colleagues agreed with me, but sufficient of them to bought the idea of a compulsory identity card, dropped it. We went ahead consulting about a voluntary card and extension of the driving licence. Because we could see no serious practical gains to government from making it compulsory for everybody to have an identity card, and by implication making it compulsory they carry it. Is it merely a waste of time and a waste of money, or is it also a threat to our civil liberties? I'm not a purist in this. I don't think that anything which in any way impinges on our civil liberties, anything which is a burden on the innocent, should be precluded if it can be shown that the risks to liberty are small and the gains to practical convenience and the working of government and the saving of money are large. We found that the gains were nugatory or non-existent, but I think the threats to liberty and freedom are significant. One must distinguish between voluntary and compulsory cards. People say, oh, it's just another bit of plastic. People voluntarily have in their wallets all sorts of bit of plastic. What's the difference between that and a card that the government produces and requires them to own? Well, there's every difference between the voluntary and the compulsory. If you fail to take with you in the morning your credit card, it's an inconvenience, but it's not a crime. If you fail to notify its loss to the bank, it's an inconvenience, potentially a financial inconvenience to you, but it's not a crime. If you fail to notify a change of details to the credit card provider, it's an inconvenience, but it's not a crime. Almost inevitably, if people were required to possess a government identity card, I think they would be effectively required to carry it, either in law or, as the last questioner I heard asked, in practice, because the police would exercise their rights to stop and search and demand that you have it. And indeed, as the, I think it was Dr. Palmer in his his 10-minute rule bill that was a sort of precursor to the government's measures, suggested the police could at least have authority in the case of someone they suspected of something who hadn't got his card on him or her card on her. They could be frog-marched, taken home, escorted home by the police up the drive and required to get it from their home or their office. Something that most of us would not like the neighbours to observe, and effectively meaning it would be compulsory to carry it. So there's every difference between voluntary and compulsory. One that's compulsory to own would become compulsory to carry, and if it's compulsory to carry, it means it's compulsory. It means you're committing a crime if you accidentally leave the home without it. You're committing a crime if you don't notify change of address or loss. You've created three new categories of criminal from the innocent population without probably having helped arrest a single genuine criminal from the previous law-breaking community. Secondly, there are the implications for privacy. Everybody, the enthusiasts for this, all want a smart card. The only purpose of having a smart card is to have lots of information on it. If you can put lots of information in it, it defies credibility that you can't get lots of information out of it. And if teenage nerds can bug the Pentagon, it's not going to be long before criminal gangs can get into or replicate smart cards. And I simply don't think that there is any uncrackable technology in this area. So one's privacy would be at stake. But also it gives, to my mind, an unacceptable power to the state. Now, I don't want to let my side down, but I don't actually think this government is a sort of totalitarian government in waiting, anxious to move us to a totalitarian state. But nonetheless, if we create the mechanisms, the means, the powers of the state, incrementally increasing its power over the citizens, then incrementally it will probably be used by future governments step by step, bit by bit, and we will move in that direction. I always remember being shocked by talking to an opposition spokesman in one of our sister parties, actually, in one of the accession states that are coming into the European Union shortly, and asked if at the next general election he won, what would be the first thing he did. And he said, well, look up the files on our opponents and see what we can get on them. And that, of course, is quite a common thing. And he was a liberty-loving chap in principle, but that was what you do when the opportunity is there. And I would rather the opportunity isn't there. We have to remember, even this government, the first thing it did when it was getting criticism from the relatives of the Paddington rail victims was ask people to find out about those people. What are they up to? What's their records? See whether we can get anything on them to shut them up. So It is a dangerous power to give to government if there are no compensating benefits. But make no mistake about it, if we were to go into a public house down the old Kent Road, or anywhere else really, and ask people, do they think it's a good idea to have compulsory identity cards, wouldn't it help cracking down with terrorism, crime, illegal immigration, and benefit fraud, they'd all say, yeah, jolly good idea. We innocent folk have got nothing to worry about. Perhaps it isn't down the Oaking Road, but we innocent folk have got nothing to worry about, and if it helps, we'd love it. That was roughly the attitude of the Australian public when the Australian government decided to introduce what they called the Australia card. An overwhelming majority of the public supported it when it was a concept. As it went through Parliament and the implications were spelt out, both for privacy and for the obligations it imposes on ordinary innocent people, opposition began to mount. The biggest civil liberties campaign ever in Australia's history spontaneously was mobilised. And eventually, the opinion poll showed that 90% of the public were against the idea, and it was duly killed off in the Australian upper house. Now, I obviously, for party political reasons, would very much like a similar fate to lie ahead of the Labour government in this country as lay ahead of the Labour government in Australia, because it subsequently fell at the next election. It was not at all unrelated to this experience with the Australia card. But on the whole, I think I'd rather we didn't go down that road at all, and I hope they will take the warnings that I've given them today to heart and realise that it's better not to start down a road which will produce very few gains, some threats to civil liberties, and some major threats to their own popularity. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Peter. Now we have three presentations from different perspectives of the likely impact of the card. I'd like to start with Terry Doughty. Terry is about to commence as joint national coordinator of the Children's Rights Alliance of England. You have heard something about the exploitation of young people so far, very eruditely put by Charles Moore. And I'd like to bring Terry up here to say a few words on this topic. Terry. Her maiden speech, I might add.
Hello. I'm here today to give voice to the concerns of and around the very large section of our population who's aged under 18. Given the length of time it would take to establish an entitlement card, I think it's probably salutary to remember that those currently shedding their milk teeth would probably be amongst the first recipients of it. Those of us who have influence, power, and a vote are accountable to the next generation for what we hand on. Children's rights aren't a matter of sentimentality, nor are they an optional extra. The UK has ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and has thus taken on obligations under international law to respect and implement all of its provisions, examining all new legislation and policy for compliance. I think it'd be particularly helpful to look at the entitlement card proposals through the window of specific articles contained in the Convention. Article 12 requires that young people be consulted on all decisions that affect them. Articles 13 and 17 require that they have access to a full range of appropriate information. Now, the Home Office did establish a unit whose purpose during this consultation period is to seek the views of young people. Nevertheless, we are concerned as to how much consultation has actually taken place and the range of information that's been made available. This having information available is very important. Its absence creates a vacuum which can easily be filled by the immediacy and excitement of a dazzling new technology. We need to be aware of the seductiveness of the wow factor, as Simon and I discovered during the issue of school libraries taking thumbprints from pupils during the summer. Within the Children's Rights Alliance, CRAE, one of our project leaders invited the Home Office unit to come and answer the questions of a group of young people involved in CRAE's You Watch project, and I deviate from my script here to give a defence of our You What initiative. It is not a Home Office initiative, and It was actually named by the 24 young people who have volunteered to undertake a very important project, translating government legislation into language that children can actually understand. I don't think we've come that far in children's rights yet, and by and large, policy documents are not child-friendly. I'm not sure they're even people-friendly most of the time. Sorry. Anyway, our project members found that many of their more searching questions simply couldn't be answered, or they were answered with, that hasn't been decided yet, we haven't made a decision. For example, they couldn't even be told at what age a card would be introduced. If you're a young person, you'll appreciate that's a pretty crucial question. How meaningful can consultation be on issues which are still so vague? In something like this, the devil is in the detail. It's rather like inviting someone to play football on a half-finished pitch and asking them to guess where the goalposts are going to be. One issue of enormous concern to all our project members was the effect of entitlement cards on those young people who are already pushed to the margins of our society. What, for instance, will be the effect of these cards on those young people who are homeless? How are they to register for cards or even know about them? What about traveller children, unaccompanied refugee children, particularly those whose first language isn't English? How will the government ensure that it acts in the best interests of each and every child as required by Article 3 of the Convention? What mechanisms will prevent any discrimination that would breach Article 2? We're told that the government does not intend to use the cards to link up information. How will this be guaranteed? And if not this government, what about future governments? This is particularly relevant for younger people. Currently, the government is using the annual school census to build an individualised year-by-year record containing sensitive information about every pupil in the state system. This database will never be deleted. The Connections database for teenagers is similarly collecting and storing a huge amount of information. It is an awful lot of information, and probably more than is held about any one of us sitting here today. If it's linked into an entitlement card system, then the entire biography of subsequent generations could be seen at the click of a mouse. Some young people experience a very turbulent passage to adulthood, either because of hardships created by their circumstances, and also just because learning has a lot to do with finding the boundaries and kicking them very hard. I'm sure I don't need to spell that out to a lot of people here today, but sadly, I think in wider society, we have lost sight of that. It is important, though, that young people later have a chance to reinvent themselves, if that's what they need to do, to make a fresh start. How would this be possible if a card forged a permanent link with a troubled childhood? Article 16 protects children from arbitrary interference with their privacy. The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, which is responsible for monitoring each country's compliance with the Convention, regularly asks for information on the protection provided, together with details of the remedies made available to a child. Will there be a complaints procedure built into any entitlement card legislation through which people can seek redress? If so, what specific efforts will be made to ensure that this is fully accessible to young people, that they're informed about it, that they know how to use it? Can we guarantee that an entitlement card will never be used as a weapon of social policing? Again, this is particularly relevant to young people. Sadly, we appear to be living in an increasingly adolescent-phobic society, which sees all young people as a legitimate target. We do blame an awful lot on children who, after all, shaped by our society. They live in it and they hold up a mirror to it. Perhaps if we looked in the mirror, we'd learn quite a lot about ourselves. Finally, I'd like to turn to Article 4 of the UN Convention. This requires that measures to ensure children's economic, social, and cultural rights are undertaken to the maximum extent of available resources. How do we have so much money available for this entitlement card scheme when one third of our children are growing up in poverty? They are not having their rights met. doesn't the maximum extent of available resources mean that we should tackle our scandalously high levels of child poverty before spending money elsewhere? To do otherwise seems rather like going off and buying a private jet while your children are going hungry. If we're thinking about providing entitlement cards, we first need to ensure that the basic rights to which people are entitled are actually being met. And if that were to happen, who knows, we might just find that we don't really need elaborate methods of social control. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. The next speaker is going to deal with what I'm sure our government friends would regard as one of the most consistently difficult issues that any government has ever had to deal with. The card raises, as we've heard earlier today, internationally, an experience that should make all of us concerned for the sort of society and the relationships, interrelationships in society, that we may be creating. I'd like to bring up onto the podium and introduce you to Dr. Clarence Lussain, who is the Social Affairs Director of the 1990 Trust. Clarence.
Good afternoon. During the apartheid government in South Africa, there was a very expensive and very large and very unworkable effort at introducing entitlement cards, pass cards. And it was a slip of the tongue. And passes were issued to people. And what the system was supposed to do was that it would allow authorities to basically approach people and determine where they belonged and how they belonged in the system. Black people would be approached and asked if they were black. White people would be approached and asked if they were white. Colored people would be approached, Asian people, with the same questions. The problem was that the system didn't work because people's rights were being restricted and people responded. And so an extensive system of overcoming those approaches came into place. So as we found out after apartheid ended, there were millions of people who got around the system. Hundreds of thousands of colors, black people, for example, passed as coloreds because the system was put in place. People were able, through the mail, to basically fake identities. The response of the apartheid government, of course, was then to increase means by which to try to identify people. So you had a back and forth that went on and on to the point where you reached levels of absurdity where there were tests of people's hair, for example, where the government determined that there was black hair, Asian hair, white hair, or colored hair. And they would use combs to decide what category you fit in. And if you didn't have any hair at all, it created a crisis in the system. So I'm not trying to compare the proposal from the government with apartheid South Africa, at least not yet. But what I do want to state is that police states certainly do not come in floods and do not come in waves, but they come in drip drops. And this is a pretty big drop that's being proposed by the UK government. If I had a title for this talk, it would be Know Them by Their Deeds. One of the things that we've been looking at the 1990 Trust has been in a number of areas, ways in which policy that on its face is a mask of neutrality, but behind that is a face of discrimination. If you look at, for example, Stop and Search, and I have some copies of our statement which gives some of these details, what you find is that a policy that was implemented ostensibly to be neutral, ostensibly to be equally applied, in fact, has never been. In the year 2000 to 2001, after several years of complaints by black communities and a decrease in overall stops and searches, when you begin to break that down, there was a 17% drop in searches during that period, which meant that for whites, the number of searches actually went down. For black and Asian communities, those numbers actually went up. In 2001, The rate of stops for whites here in London was 19 per 1,000. For Asian communities, it was 37. For black communities, it was 95. In other words, it was about five times the national average. That's know them by their deeds. What we're witnessing here in the UK is an infringement and attack on civil liberties that has to be put in, that puts this new proposal in a context that makes it an overall threat to us. When we look at the proposal to eliminate jury trials, the proposal to end double jeopardy rules, all of these are drops of attacks on the civil rights and civil liberties and political rights of people in this country that when framed, and also by the extension of that to the way it impacts on communities of color, takes on an even more kind of deadly seriousness. The term entitlement is actually a very loaded kind of term. And the title of our position paper is Entitlement to What? Are people being entitled to more services? I don't think so. Are people being entitled to more rights? No, the government doesn't make this argument. In fact, what it is people are basically being entitled to surrender the quality of their citizenship for the dubious promise of less crime, more security, happier lives. In fact, this is a citizenship profiling card, as we see it. Now, I also want to take some offense at a statement that was made earlier that there's a sense among constituents that there's support for this proposal. These are not the constituents that we deal with every day out in Brixton, out in Clapham, out in other parts of the city, and in fact, other parts of the country, who are citizens, not illegal immigrants, not bogus asylum seekers, not all of the terms that are used as part of this hysteria that the country has been going through since September 11th. But these are people who are citizens who, because of their experience in this country and the disproportionate way in which their rights have been abridged, are very much against this proposal, and to the degree there would have been a consultancy that would have lasted the entire 6 months instead of one day, those views would have come about. As it was pointed out earlier, as the education process happened in Australia, people became more and more aware of their rights being attacked and, in fact, started to oppose that. The government wants to point to countries like Germany and other places where they have ID cards, but it doesn't talk about places like Japan or the States where people very much are against ID cards because the culture of citizenship rights and the culture of constitutional rights are so ingrained that people's antennas are much higher and much stronger in seeing these attacks as fundamentally restructuring their ability to live in free societies, free and democratic societies. The last thing I want to do is, the last points I want to make, is looking at this in the context of the attacks in the anti-terrorism framework that the government has been able to exploit. Many of these ideas, of course, precede September 11th, precede the period that we're in, but had very little currency and very little ability on the parts of government, whether it's conservative government or liberal governments, or Labor Party governments, to be implemented and to go anywhere. But the government has recognized the ability now to exploit a situation where people do feel threatened. People do feel that we're in a situation where virtually every single corner there's a bomb waiting to go off. Exploiting that situation means that a whole range of proposals are going to be coming through, many of which the government itself knows will not pass, but that some will. And we have to be very vigilant, I think, in looking at that as it attacks the rights of all of us, but in particular communities that are already marginalized, that are already vulnerable, that are already on the edge, that are already feeling the effects of disproportionate applications of criminal justice laws. We have to be vigilant about that. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Clarence. There was a moment, you know, a few years ago, a window of opportunity for medical privacy. It was in the era when Dr. Fleur Fisher was head of ethics, science, and information at the BMA, supported by a small group of diligent, very intelligent and aware people in the health profession. I'm so proud to bring to the stage one of those people. Marion Chester is Legal Affairs Director of the Association of Community Health Councils of England and Wales, has been a staunch supporter of privacy in the face of extraordinary opposition from government, and I'd like to bring her now to talk about the health issues. Thank you, Marion.
Thank you, Simon. Now, the proposals contained within the Home Office consultation document on entitlement cards are of particular concern to NHS patients. If they don't know it now, they soon will. The issues which need to be addressed are how the use of these entitlement cards will be used to control access to health services, what information will be stored in the cards or in the databases, and how will that information be protected against breaches of confidentiality, and also against inaccuracies, which I will show you later can be very, very damaging, and identity fraud. And as has been mentioned, there are costs implications for service provision. Now, it is self-evident that the introduction of entitlement cards will be used to deny services to those that the government consider not to be entitled to them. Health service provision is a basic necessity. It is not something we can say some people are entitled to and some people are not in a civilised society. Occasionally, overseas visitors find that they are being queried before they're questioned before they get their services. And the questioning is about who is going to pay for this. Now, this is becoming more prevalent, as I think we heard earlier on, where people are being referred to hospital for treatment and they're being turned away because they can't establish that they have the identity of a British citizen and thus the entitlement to those services. That will get worse. Frontline health professionals will be required to police the system. And those of us who hold entitlement cards will find they are not voluntary. We will not be able to go out without them in case we have an accident. I know that it is being said that that is a ridiculous argument. However, it is precisely the situation that people are already finding themselves in if there are serious questions raised about their identity, their citizenship. There are also currently moves within the health service to ration services. We've seen in social services the rationing of services to the elderly, for example, home helps. In fact, almost every social services type of support is now only available if you meet certain eligibility criteria. This is creeping into the health service. Be warned, it's there. Only this morning I had a call from a community health council that said, we're being told that elderly people here are not going to be eligible for podiatry services. They have to meet certain eligibility criteria. Otherwise, if they don't, they'll have to pay for it privately. Now, it doesn't take much to realise that if you're going to be carrying an entitlement card to a service, you're going to be carrying an entitlement card which identifies which services you're going to be entitled to. It will be an instrument that will assist those who wish to ration services. The Department of Health is currently selling proposals to introduce an electronic health record scheme. All patient records will be stored centrally electronically. These records will contain information gleaned from each patient from the cradle to the grave and allow access, yes, to the patients, but also to health service personnel and to other government departments. The electronic health record appears to be a precursor to the entitlement cards which are now being proposed by the Home Office. The benefits that are being promised to patients through the electronic health record scheme outweigh the risks that are being acknowledged. Possible benefits do include easy access by patients to their own records, the end of lost test results, and anyone who's gone to a hospital appointment and found that their time has been wasted because their test results have been lost and they've got to come back next week, next month, will know how irritating that is.
and access to important information by those providing emergency health care, particularly to a patient who is unable to communicate because of the injuries they've suffered. However, there are significant risks with this sort of system which have not even been considered, never mind addressed. Breaches of confidentiality, what to do about inaccuracies, the problem of identity fraud, and the rationing of services according to eligibility criteria, as I've mentioned. Now, there are very genuine confidentiality concerns. Almost without exception, we've told our GPs and other medical practitioners within the NHS a lot of information about ourselves, including marital problems, sexual histories, mental health concerns, and a range of other information, which includes information about our families and possible genetic predispositions to medical conditions. Now, we all know doctors have a very real interest in receiving this information so that they can accurately diagnose and treat us. And as long as there's been a medical profession, they've held the confidences of patients in confidence. They know how important it is. They know that breaches of confidence have the potential to destroy the trust between the patient and the doctor, and that patients may in future withhold possibly vital information. A widespread breakdown in patient trust would have serious consequences, not only for the treatment of individuals, but for public health. But there are trends and developments within the health service and society as a whole that are undermining patient confidentiality. Patients recognise and accept that treating physicians, whether it's their GP or a consultant or some other person who's involved in their treatment, do need to have access to information about them. But the NHS now requires medical practitioners to pass on identifiable patient information for a variety of other purposes, including financial and clinical audit and the planning of health services. Once that information has been passed on, it's then used for a multitude of other purposes, including research carried out both within the NHS and the private sector. Now, in the past, the physical nature of patient records provided some sort of protection. This is no longer the case. GPs who were able to control access to paper records now cannot say who is accessing the records once they have been placed on a database. Once they've been passed on, they may be passed on again and again and again in the same or a modified form. Now, we're all aware of the fiasco concerning the Inland Revenue Database, which allowed those who logged on to the Revenue's website access to other taxpayers' details. Just think how much more damaging it would have been if what they'd accessed was the medical records of individuals rather than their financial affairs. The Department of Health also plays down the possibility that it might be possible to hack into their databases. I know that it can be done. I have sat and watched it being done. It's very simple for an experienced hacker to get into almost any government database. Once medical records are stored electronically on these databases, there will be very real risks that anyone who wishes to gain access to them will be able to do so by employing experienced professional hackers. Another problem with these databases, and believe me, ID cards do not come without the databases, there's no point. At present, most health records contain inaccuracies ranging from incomplete recording of symptoms through to serious misdiagnoses. A recent survey by the National Audit Office indicated that about 40% of medical records they looked at contained obvious errors. This is not by reference to the patient. An inaccurately recorded diagnosis can lead to treatment that doesn't benefit the patient and may even harm them or others. Medical, lifestyle, or family information can and has been used by insurers and others in such a way as to make decisions which adversely affect the patient. Even accurate information can be damaging in the wrong hands. I once acted for a gentleman who was being harassed by his neighbours. He was a local authority tenant. The local authority, his housing officer, decided that he was the one who was the cause of the problem. couldn't understand why. They took him to court. They wanted to evict him. A statement was made that he was an alcoholic. He wasn't. What had happened was the housing officer, who shared an office with social services, had had access to parts of his medical record, which showed that he had liver damage, which had been caused by a genetic condition. He assumed he was an alcoholic. The man nearly lost his home. Thankfully, we managed to put the court right. However, the council did not apologise, nor did they take action against the neighbours who'd been harassing him, because they somehow felt it was his fault that they got the information wrong. Now, a patient who has identified an inaccuracy in their medical records can ask for the paper record and can ask for it to be corrected. It may not be that easy, but it's a damn sight easier than tracking down information that's held on a range of different databases and then persuading the authorities that be to change them where there are inaccuracies. People at the moment don't know where their records are being held. Do you think they're going to make it any more likely that they will tell us? No. This government is proceeding with other governments in Europe to try and persuade to try and make changes to the privacy directive to ensure that we are not given details about who holds data on us. Identity fraud is a growing problem for citizens. Ironically, it appears that most identity fraud is based upon information held on citizens by government bodies. The more information that's held about us, the more material there is for the fraudsters. If entitlement services is made dependent upon the production of an entitlement card, those who, for whatever reason, are deemed not to be entitled, and thus not entitled to an entitlement card, will be more likely to be tempted into identity fraud. Now, people who've been the subject of credit card identity fraud, and I know too, feel as though their lives have been invaded and destabilised for quite a long period. It can cause mental health problems. Those who've had their identity stolen by those wishing to gain access to services are likely to be even more severely damaged if they know that the fraudsters have been able to access and use their medical and family histories. Finally, there are very real concerns that the costs involved in setting up a system, whether it be an electronic health record system or a national IT scheme, which will be needed to support the ID cards, will be massive. Those costs will be clawed back from service budgets, with resulting cuts in services and even more extreme rationing. Thank you.
Thank you, Marion. Before we go to Q&A, can we have a quick hand count using the same statistical logic applied by the government in its press release this morning? Can we have a show of hands for those who are comfortable with the way this consultation has proceeded to this point? Okay, not many comfort, sort of warm and fuzzy feelings there. How many people here feel that something has gone wrong with the consultation? Right, okay, we have more. Okay, all right. Well, okay, I won't do the counting, but I think you can judge for yourselves. The Home Office is still here, so hopefully that signal will be sent out. Can I bring Ian Brown back for Q&A? We are running woefully over time, but if we can spend 10 minutes on Q&A, I'll say a few words in conclusion and throw over to you, Ian.
Thanks, Simon. Questions? It's this gentleman down at the front.
Yeah, this is a question that more or less addresses the whole of this issue. And it's not just this specific piece of legislation, re-ID cards, but also, as was mentioned by somebody on the podium, as regards legislation which is due in the Queen's speech, re-watering away of the various rights. But the thing is, I mean, what I find really disturbing is the fact that one of the main architects behind the whole of this, these raft of issues, is somebody who is not democratically accountable, i.e. Lord Falconer. Nobody elected him, he's not accountable. And similarly, another person who's also a main architect is the Lord Chancellor, Lord Irvine, again, not democratically accountable. And I'd be very interested from a from such as Peter Lilly, who is a lawyer, who would see the watering away of civil liberties. And doesn't it seem somewhat surprising that these people who are not democratically accountable seem to be the main architects behind this raft of legislation or proposed legislation, which is slowly but surely watering away the erstwhile civil liberties of this country?
Well, I'll happily endeavour to answer, though, repudiating the slur that I'm a lawyer. I'm not here to defend the government, but the government, obviously, all ministers are accountable to Parliament and ultimately to, because all government stands and falls together, to the electorate. Also, I would have thought that one of the moving forces behind these measures has been the Home Secretary, David Blunkett, who is democratically accountable to the Democratic House. So, ultimately, one's going to win or lose these debates by showing up the strength or weaknesses of their arguments more than by simply saying which house they respond to in answering those arguments.
Any questions up at the top? No? Any more questions down here? Loster, do you want to ask something?
I remarked earlier that the Home Office seems to come up with an ID card proposal of some scheme or of some kind or another every couple of years. It seems that there is there are a range of interests in government. The Home Office is pro-ID card. The Treasury is presumably against. I wonder if, given your experience in government, you can give any tips to people who are campaigning against the ID card as to how these disagreements might best be exploited.
Well, again, the most potent means is to say, well, which departments are going to pay for it? If you say to the police, is there anything in it that might be useful to them in the abstract, you might get a wishy-washy but favourable answer. If you say, is there anything that is useful to them for which they're prepared to pay out of their budget, you will get a very different answer, and the same will be true for each department in turn, which has an alleged benefit coming from it. It's actually quite interesting that the government's almost resiled from the four key areas that I talked of and now talks about this helping commercial businesses, even though they do in their documents say that most of the biographical history necessary to confirm someone's identity is at present better held by the commercial sector, by the credit agencies, than it is by government itself. So it's a rather circular system. And I suspect the commercial sector would not want to pay for this either. They're quite happy to have it provided free, but they wouldn't be prepared to pay for it.
This gentleman down here in the burgundy jumper. Could you wait for a microphone for a moment, please?
I think it was Dr. Palmer earlier who talked about hour after hour of filling in form after form. But, he seems to be defending the scheme. I'm interested in the lack of cost-benefit analysis covering any concept of the cost to the user. I mean, as an absolute minimum, it seems to me, with biometrics involved, one has to physically go there. I can't see that taking less getting the documents together and going there than perhaps half a day. If one assumes that maybe an average earning citizen's earning about 24,000 a year or something like that, then we're looking at about 3 billion cost just simply on citizen compliance without even taking account of all the factors for what it costs them to actually have forgotten their card on one occasion or something like that, or indeed to prove their identity when their biometrics go out of date. There's another factor to the cost benefit here, which is that technology projects of this magnitude have on record, I speak as an IT project manager here, about a 1 in 3 chance of success, and very rarely come in on budget, never come in under budget. And if you take an example like, say, the Nimrod project or something like that, you're looking at a factor of 9 cost overrun. Since the best estimate we've had so far of the actual cost benefits on the plus side was, I think, a fraction of a 1.3 billion fraud spend. I think, as Lily said, about 150 million might perhaps be saved there. We're not really looking at a very positive cost-benefit ratio, and I was wondering if the department's proposing this might be able to put me right.
I don't think they're here, unfortunately, to to do that. But is there somebody up here? Wendy?
Thanks. In what you were just saying a minute ago about, I was a little alarmed in the consultation document to read about the government sharing information with its partners. It sounded terribly business speak, and it made me really wonder what they had in mind. But the question I really wanted to ask was, why is there such significance attached to the difference between it not being compulsory to carry it and being compulsory to... I mean, what is really the difference between having to produce it on the spot or having to produce it in 7 days? I would have thought having to produce it in 7 days was actually more inconvenient. But why is that seen as better somehow?
Well, I mean, it's clearly barking mad to have a system where you ask people to produce it in 7 days, because if they are a criminal, terrorist, or fraudster, they're not going to come in 7 days' time, and you will then know that you'd stop the right person. So that... Well, because making it compulsory to carry, what that means is making it a crime not to carry. It's making it a crime to leave your home without it. Now, you may all be frightfully good at remembering everything. I occasionally forget my wallet. If I forgot my wallet with my identity card in it, I would be committing a crime. It'd be quite serious for a legislator to commit a crime, but it would be quite serious for any of us. So that's what it means, and that's why a compulsory carriage of a card is a serious matter. They know that. Therefore, they're doing it by stages. First of all, you have to have it. No question of making it compulsory to carry it. Once you've got it, it's as sure as night follows day, it will become compulsory to carry it. Then, as sure as night follows day, there'll be such outrage that it will have to cease to be. I remember as a child in France, walking with my French pen friend through Paris, and there'd been a bomb outrage of some kind, and we were stopped by an armed military patrol. And my chum, was terrified because he hadn't got his card with him, and at that stage it was compulsory to carry them. I'd been told by my father that Englishmen didn't have that sort of thing. That was a continental aberration. I just said to the officer, I'm English, I don't have to carry them, and walked past while he sort of looked in astonishment. But now I lack the courage and foolhardiness of youth, I wouldn't dare do it. But they had to give up making it compulsory to carry it in France, but they still exist. So it will go in waves one way or the other, but it will be damaging.
Okay, this gentleman down here in the middle.
Where?
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Mason. I'm a barrister that specialises in e-risks and electronic signatures. And it's very interesting to hear Ross Anderson's points about the technology, which I'm aware of, which actually breaks down and does not work and can be actually changed by anybody who chooses to do it. It's just an observation, really. And one of the points about this whole object of the government to introduce these identification cards is possibly to introduce extra materials on the card which is protected by an electronic signature device of one sort or another. And in most cases, they will probably buy electronic signature devices from the commercial sector. And if they do so, those devices will have to go through several hands. So not only, as in our last speaker's point made out, that the information will actually be in a lot of different government departments, but our identities will also be predisposed or premeditated on the fact that our electronic or digital signature will also have to go through an identification process through other commercial means as well, which adds to the entire complexity of the whole card. And that's the point I would like to make.
Okay, thanks. Could we have one final question? Maybe it's great to hear what Peter Lilly has had to say, but maybe for one of the other speakers. Gentleman in the grey at the back.
My question was for Marion Chester. I've been looking at the consultation paper's estimates on costs, and I don't understand them. I thought that with cards you had to have something to read them, and I don't see anything that explains to me where the card reader infrastructure is going to come from. And if we're going to have card reader devices in every GP surgery, every clinic and every hospital, presumably the money has to come from somewhere. Could you tell me whether the NHS Information Authority's latest budget plans actually include any money for this? And perhaps Terry Doughty might want to say whether local authorities actually have money for this kind of thing, for the sheer scale of reader infrastructure that they're going to have to buy, particularly for the services for children that you care about.
Difficult question to answer because the NHS Information Authority's budget is not something that I have access to. But I would say to you that they are budgeting for the use of electronic health records. And they're obviously going to be hoping that the same technology is going to be used for entitlement cards. Otherwise, they're going to have to spend out on it twice. But the point that will be of absolutely no surprise to you is that each hospital and each GP surgery, each podiatry clinic, each social services department, each library is going to have to provide out of their own budgets for this sort of hardware. There's no way that the government's going to ship them across the country and give them out free to every outlet that's going to require them.
Is this the right sort of height? Can everyone hear me? I honestly don't know what the costings are for this within local authorities, but I would say that there is already the connections card system for 13 to 19 year olds. Whether there is any intention that there would be a link between them, I really don't know, but certainly, there obviously exists the technology to read cards at the moment for teenagers.
Okay, we'll end there. That was.
What about that
has you had? No, I didn't see. Okay, one more question.
We heard a lot of soft soap from Lord Faulkner, the man of the dome, and saying that they're not going to put all this information on the card. Well, you don't have to merge databases. You have an ID number. That is the key. It can get anywhere you like. Now, I want to know is when are they going to use that unique number to match up with your voting record so if you vote using the number, they know who you are and who you voted for. ADSL now means that the information is readily available. Let's not look at the cost, because the government will spend anything it can in order to put its agenda across. Let's make no mistake about this at all. There's someone here is bound to think if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear, but there's something called privacy. And this government, Peter, they are totalitarian, but by stealth. They're doing it just marketing in a better way. My children will not be getting cards, nor will I, nor my wife, and damn the consequences. I'm sorry, I am not going to put up with being tracked everywhere. And anyone who wants to know how to read these cards, it's very simple. How many of you came on the underground today? Did you see the little yellow, black and yellow thing on the turnstile? It reads smart cards. They're tracking 80,000 members of London Transport at the moment. All they need to do is put a microwave reader in every single lamppost or wherever, and they'll know who you are and where you've been. And all they need is a number. And the traffic master system is now being used for microchipped number plates, which are coming in 2004. And I don't intend to have them. I'm number two refuse, Nick. I refuse.
Okay, could we thank our speakers from that last panel session?
And thank you, Ian. Unfortunately, we do have to leave because there's another session happening in the old theatre, so our time is coming to an end. One thing I would ask, again, thanking our partner organisations, FIPA and Liberty, who I omitted to thank before, But please, we have 6 weeks left in this consultation period. Can we just have a quick vote here? Could I propose that this meeting puts to the Home Office that the consultation period, two things, the consultation period be extended by a further 6 months, and two, that the government takes its responsibilities seriously in engendering a public debate. Can we have a show of hands for any support for that? Almost unanimous, thank you. We will communicate that. And good luck to all of you, and thank you for coming.